Ladies and gentlemen, it's rainmaking time. Welcome to today's show. Today, our guest is Jay Dwight, who is a registered investment advisor who owns Dwight Investment Counsel in the state of Maine. He's a registered investment advisor, a columnist with Populist Economics at the Sun Journal. He's on the advisory board of the Maine Heritage Policy Center, a speaker on energy independence. He's president of the Kennebunk Land Trust, former president of the Rachel Carson Natural Wildlife Preserve, and former board member of the Maine Audubon Society. Now, he calls himself a bird nerd because he leads bird trips since the age of 14, leading whale watches, bird counts, breeding bird surveys, hawk watches. This is a man you want to listen to who has some very interesting insight and things you haven't thought about regarding wind power, debt and deficit funding, aggregate demand, and a whole host of other things that are relevant to think about regarding the environment, cost economies, etc. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Jay Dwight to It's Rainmaking Time. Good morning.
Thank you, Kim, for your time and for the opportunity to speak with me about these issues. Thank you.
When we first spoke, you shared about the state of Maine and that there's this great focus on alternative energy. It's a rural, mountainous place with a lot of natural environmental attraction. What do we need to know about what's happening in Maine today?
As far as wind power goes, generally, the biggest problem is that wind is not an effective source of electricity or cost-effective either. It's not efficient or cost-effective. And Maine has been the focus of development by a company called First Wind, which actually is the largest privately owned wind power company in the United States. It has operations not only in Maine, it has operations in New York, Wisconsin, and Hawaii. It also has a subsidiary called Deepwater Wind, which is into offshore wind power farms. This company happens to be owned by D.E. Shaw and Marston Dearborn, two hedge funds, which one of which is located out of New York, and Marston Dearborn actually is located out of Chicago, Illinois. What's interesting about D.E. Shaw, David Shaw is the founding member of that particular company, hedge fund, managed about $14 billion. He is now employed by the Obama administration as their, hang on a second, I'm pulling up exactly. He's been appointed to the Council of Economic Advisors in Science and Technology in 1994 by Clinton and is now again by President Obama in 2009. So he's a member of the study group on presidential science and technology advisory assets. So he's directly involved with wind within the Obama administration. Lawrence Summers, who was previous president of Harvard University, worked for D.E. Shaw for a few years and then went to the Obama administration. While he was at D.E. Shaw, he earned $5.2 million. Now, D.E. Shaw's interest in First Wind is they own half of the company. Marston Dearborn is also out of Chicago. They have tight connections with Rahm Emanuel. Both these companies are benefiting directly from stimulus funds through grants that D.E. Shaw received through First Wind for projects they had already built and constructed in Maine. One is the Mars Hill wind farm, and the other is Cohocton Wind out in New York. They received $150 million of our taxpayer money directly. Wind power is probably the most expensive and most heavily subsidized source of electricity in the United States at $23.45 per kilowatt. The next near highest, you know, everyone says that nuclear energy is the most subsidized. Well, it's not. They only receive about 65 cents a kilowatt or 0.65 per megawatt. So why this is a problem is all this money is going down into the First Wind and right back out to a hedge fund. None of it's staying in the state of Maine particularly at all. And they're going to be driving up the cost of electricity for not only Mainers but all over the country to the tune of where Maine will be paying something in the order of 24 to 50 cents a kilowatt for power.
What is it now?
Right now it's about 15 cents, including the transmission. interestingly enough, the transmission company is owned, Central Maine Power is owned by Eastern Utility Association, which is owned by a Spanish company named Iberdrola. Iberdrola has been driving this throughout Europe, and the cost of electricity in Europe is somewhere in the area of, depending on what country you're in, 30 to 50 cents a kilowatt right now, after they put in thousands of wind turbines, which don't work effectively to reduce CO2 emissions at all or reduce oil or natural gas dependency one iota.
Is that a fact? Does it reduce oil and gas efficiency? Seriously?
Seriously. There have been several studies by independent authorities in Spain, Denmark, and Germany. And in Spain's experience, not only did... here's a quote directly from the... So the experience reveals that these policies would be terribly economically counterproductive. Since 2000, for every four green jobs they're created, nine permanent jobs were lost. 2.2 jobs were lost for every green job created. High-paying, high-tech, sustainable permanent jobs were lost to other countries, notably France, Brazil, and the Middle East. Denmark, there were no net job gains, despite the fact that Vestas, which is the largest producer of wind turbines in the entire world, the Danish economy is worse by the diversion of societal resources to wind power jobs. In Germany, policymakers, according to the study, quote, should regard the country's experience as a cautionary tale devoid of economic and environmental benefits. So if we're going to learn from, if we're going to follow the same path, we should actually learn from the experiences of our European cousins. And in every case, economically, that we're worse off, and environmentally, no improvement whatsoever.
I will say one thing. I myself have never understood wind power. I know there's been a huge attraction to it and about it, but I never understood it, A. B, I never understood the economics of it. And C, I'm not sure the audiences do. I just learned, though, just an interesting factoid. I just did two shows on the grid, specifically related to electromagnetic pulse and also geomagnetic storms and how our transformers in the grid are in a terribly vulnerable position. And one of the interesting things that I discovered yesterday was that in some cases it would be valuable, maybe not economically, but as a backup to have wind power or any other type of power that wasn't totally dependent upon the grid. Because I don't know if wind necessitates being connected to the grid the way everything else does.
Oh, yeah. In fact, the grid system that we have today is developed upon a completely different premise than wind power even can provide. The premise is that you have a stable system, and the use of electricity is pretty much it varies on a daily basis. It goes down to a base level at night and rises up during the day when use is heavy, and then back down again at night. The cycle, of course, runs pretty much with the business day, higher use from 7 to, say, 9 o'clock at night, and then dropping off back down to about 6 o'clock in the morning when it begins to go up again. So it's a regular cycle. So there's this thing called base load power, and then there's this thing called peak power. And peak power also comes into play when you get really hot days in the summer when electricity use goes up because of air conditioning, or really cold days in the winter when electricity use may go up because of some homes being heated by electricity. In Maine, 80% of the homes are heated by heating oil, and about 52% of the electricity produced is produced by natural gas.
When you say heating oil, what do you mean? I'm sorry. I don't know what that means.
Heating oil?
Yeah.
Well, diesel fuel basically is used to power and burn to heat water, which is then pumped around a house to warm rooms.
Okay.
So heating oil, the Northeast is the heaviest user of heating oil in the entire country, and 80% of that oil, 80% of the homes in Maine use heating oil to keep themselves warm in the winter. Of that, about 80% of it comes from Newfoundland, not from overseas, from Venezuela or Saudi Arabia or anything like that. So the problem with wind is that wind will change the amount of speed depending on from 7 to approximately about 18 miles an hour. That's the most effective speed for wind to be at in order to turn the blades and to turn the turbine and produce electricity. Once you get above 20 miles an hour, it's too fast, and they have to shut them down. And once you're below 7 miles an hour, it's too slow to keep the turbine blades turning.
So it's an intricate balance of what would be actually useful.
Correct.
But your main tenet with wind so far is it's too expensive and it's not efficient enough. Is that what you're saying?
It has no efficiency whatsoever to the grid because it will provide electricity only to the grid when the wind is within that speed between 7 and, say, 18 or 20 miles an hour. So because that wind speed can vary minute to minute, day to day, year to, you know, year over year, and it's like buying a luxury automobile and going outside and trying to turn the engine on only when, you know, the wind is 7 to 20 miles an hour. It will only run then. And no modern economy can base itself on such an erratic source of power.
So why do you think people in high places and heads of industry and political people are so deeply entrenched in wind? What is it?
It's our money they're taking from us. They love the money. And they're kind of bought to the idea that by being on wind, it will produce electricity, which can be stored somewhere, which there's no technology for us to do that right now, which then could be used to reduce hydrocarbon dependence or hydrocarbon use. And every European country that has tried this approach, their natural gas and coal use actually increased rather than decreased because you have to keep these electric power plants that are based on coal, natural gas, or oil running as stand-up reserve in case the wind dies, which it can from second to second.
Okay, I get that.
So they have to keep these coal and gas-fired plants turning on standby reserve in order to pick up the slack on the second that wind power dies. And it's really difficult to manage that grid problem because you can't, you know, say a natural gas plant is located in one place and the wind turbines are located on top of a mountain and the wind dies, you know, over a 30-minute or even a 15-minute period, you got to immediately ramp up the say, natural gas plant in order to pick up the lack of power coming down from the mountain, from the wind turbines.
You know, this information is like taking the wind out of their sails.
Absolutely. And the only way to make this work financially is through government subsidies.
And what does that mean, really? What does that translate as? People hear the word government subsidies, but what does that mean?
Okay, right now that means because we're running deficits, that means that we're adding to the deficit, which adds to our debt load, which decreases the ability for Maine to be competitive, or even the United States to be competitive worldwide, and increases the cost for every business trying to do business and get loans in order to start a new business. So government subsidies actually are the wrong way for us to go. We should go much more toward, you know, private enterprise and less government interference. Now, with government subsidies itself, for instance, let me just put it this way. For a typical plant system in Maine, say 20 turbines on a mountaintop, it would cost $2.5 million to put these things up on the mountaintop, not including the amount of roads or transmission lines you have to put up also to get to that mountaintop, about $2.5 million per turbine. So you put up 20 turbines, that's $50 million. The day they turn on the power to that particular wind turbine farm, the owner or developer of that particular site gets a 30% grant from the federal government. Used to be in the form of tax credits. Now it's a cash payment. So that's $15 million, boom, right up front. Now, additionally to that, they get a 13 cents a kilowatt renewable energy credit, cash or credit they can use to sell on the market. Plus they get so for every kilowatt they produce, they get 13 cents also, cash out of the pockets of taxpayers. So but right now, of course, the federal government is running deficits, so we're adding to our debt by producing wind power. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. It's depressing.
It's the wrong way to go.
Why are people so attracted to it? I guess there's this notion of saving the planet, saving energy, saving money. There's this assumption of all of that with wind. I know in my perception, I've always felt that. I always thought that. I assumed it. Let me put it to you that way. I assumed it with no understanding the details.
Okay. The major assumption, or the major, the proponents of wind power use the following phrases. In other words, they want to increase jobs, green jobs specifically, right? Increase, we'll have green jobs and that will get us over the hump and we'll be better off.
I've heard that.
It'll decrease foreign fossil fuel use. In other words, get energy independence.
Right.
And that it's greener because, you know, it doesn't burn hot fossil fuels. So our CO2 emissions will be reduced and green, therefore global warming will be nullified.
Well, just so you know, I did a show on CO2 and talked to a scientist who's worked his entire life on this.
Yep.
In my findings on this show and the many hours of due diligence I did on CO2,
yep,
this is food for plants.
Absolutely.
This is,
yep,
you know, nutrients for life.
Yep.
So it's like the series of assumptions. If you don't get into the detail and you separate apples from oranges and really get clear what is what, then you just assume that everything in the conversation and in the matrix of everything green is appropriate and is going to reach this economy of scale and stimulate business and produce all this stuff. I mean, that's the conversation that's being had. I assumed it myself as well. But speak more about the aggregate demand and stimulating the economy. You were just getting onto that.
Okay, well, let's just finish up on CO2 for a few minutes, if you don't mind.
No, go ahead.
There are so many misunderstandings about what CO2 is and what actually happens. Here's a question for you. What percentage of the entire contribution to the global atmosphere is mankind's contribution to CO2? What percentage?
I have no idea.
Well, it's 4%. The U.S. contribution itself is only 1%. All the rest are natural sources of CO2 emissions.
How did you get that distilled information?
I do a lot of reading. In other words, where did I get it?
Yeah, or how
Google that. Google what percentage is mankind's contribution to CO2, and the answer will come up.
That's a great question.
Okay, so 96% of all CO2 emissions annually come from natural sources. Only 4% mankind caused, and only 1% is U.S. contribution itself. Okay, one of these statistics that these people put out all the time is, you know, U.S. represents only 4% of the world population, yet we use 17% of the world's energy or hydrocarbons, right? And therefore, mankind has to be a source of major pollution, which is just wrong. But the other stupid statistic they forget is the United States produces 45% of the world's GDP. So our efficiency is huge compared to the rest of the world. Anyway, 4% is the mankind's contribution. 1% is U.S. So here's the next one. What contribution does CO2 have to the greenhouse effect? In other words, is CO2 a major cause of greenhouse effect? The answer to that is no. Water vapor is the largest contributor to the greenhouse effect, amounting to almost 98%. CO2 is only 0.11% of the total of the contribution.
Can that be verified?
Yes.
Okay.
Next is... Here's a more fundamental question than that. Answer this. What's the most common gas in the atmosphere where you and I breathe every day? What's the most common gas?
Oxygen.
Wrong. Nitrogen.
So much for my science details.
78%.
I've just been fired from my science class.
All right.
Ladies and gentlemen, ignore what I just said.
Nitrogen,
the answer is
the
nitrogen.
Most common gas in the atmosphere, okay? The composition of nitrogen is approximately 78% of the world's atmosphere. Oxygen is the second most common at 21%. It ranges between 18 and 20%, 21%, depending on if you're at sea level. I'm talking about sea level, okay? The next most common gas is argon at 0.93% approximately. Other gases represent 0.376%, and actually CO2 represents about 0.35%. 0.35%, less than almost one-third of 1% of the Earth's atmosphere is CO2. That's the big picture. Of the CO2 that gets out into the atmosphere every year, only 1% comes from the United States, 3% from the rest of the world. So really, it's in the margin of error, right? It's within the margin of error. You really can't distinguish between mankind-produced CO2 and naturally-produced CO2. So for mankind to say that if we remove 1%, if the United States went back to pre-1600 days, we still would have a negligible effect on the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, period. In other words, we'd have to destroy our entire economy to go back to pre-civilization. It's just silly, absurd. Now, here's what's more interesting. Okay, so the four major drivers of... here's another question for you. What caused the ice ages... Repeated ice age, and I repeat the word repeated ice age over the last 4.7 million years. And what is the year cycle? How many thousands of years are the cycles?
I really should know this because I did a whole piece on the ice ages.
Okay, ice ages started about 4.7 million years ago because the North American continent and Greenland went far enough north to cut off the Pacific littoral current from going into the Arctic and the Gulf Stream from going into the Arctic. Prior to then, there were no polar bears. Arctic Ocean was open all the time. First, so the plate tectonics, theory of plate tectonics says that, you know, continents move around, and these continents move far enough north. So, but why is the cycle repeated? Well, the repeated cycle is approximately 100,000 years of ice age. In other words, glaciers cover the entire North American continent and all of, most of Europe and Russia. Then every 100,000 years, they begin to thaw, and there's an interglacial period of about 35,000 years, 25 to 35, depending on which scientists you talk to. So why does it do that? The answer to that is that there are two actual global orbits of the Earth around the sun. One's a little bit further out and longer, and the other's a little closer in and shorter.
And the point is?
The point is, if you believe in global warming, believe that mankind can have an impact on plate tectonics, the currents, ocean currents of the Earth, or the orbits of Earth around the sun. If you don't believe that mankind can have an impact on any one of those three, don't believe in global warming. It's just that simple. Mankind cannot affect the climate. That's the point. Because the sun and the Earth have much more macro environmental impact on it than man can ever think about having. Not that we don't affect the local environment. That we definitely can do that. And so, mankind has done things to change the local environment. But we can't affect the global climate.
What are you recommending for having cost-effective solutions to advocate and prepare for energy independence, if there is such a thing? I think there is always interdependence on this earth.
Right.
I do understand the concept of energy independence, but... What energy solution that's on your radar right now that you're looking at that you think should be utilized?
Well, short-term and long-term?
Yes.
What do you want to talk about first?
I want to talk about both.
All right, short-term?
Yep.
There are several steps we can take. Immediately short-term, number one, open up exploration on our continental shelves first. And continue to open up exploration of natural gas resources in the United States and other hydrocarbon resources.
And that would manifest as what?
It would manifest at a lower price worldwide for the price of oil and gas, because automatically people who've really studied this, and I've done some study into this, we have, I don't know if you know this, but America is the world's third largest producer of hydrocarbons.
Explain what a hydrocarbon is.
Oil and natural gas.
Okay.
Okay. Third largest producer worldwide. Despite the fact we've been doing it for over 100 years, we're still the third largest producer. And the only reason why we're not the largest producer is that we aren't allowed by our government to do so. our government shuts down our ability to even look for it. It's illegal to look for used seismic activity.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. This has been true since 1972 when Carter came into office. We are not allowed to use seismic activity off our coast, period. End of statement.
What do you mean we are not allowed to use seismic activity?
You can't go looking for oil off our coast, except in the Gulf of Mexico, off Louisiana and Texas.
And why is that? Is that because it's federal domain?
It's federal domain, correct. Off 3 miles off most coasts in the United States, it's all Minerals and Management Service, which is U.S. government under U.S. Fish and Wildlife. And it was an executive order by Carter that shut it down.
Can it be repealed?
Bush opened it back up, and Obama shut it down again.
Got it. Well, maybe it is that governments are in the gas and oil business. I mean, maybe that's part of what people need to understand. That makes it a politically controllable domain. There's no way to privatize that once a domain is locked up, is there?
Privatize.
Well, I mean, making oil and gas available, the energy companies are private, so why wouldn't this be?
What Alaska, I think an example, you can either use Maritime Canada or Alaska as an example of how it can work and work well. Texas is also one. I don't know that experience as well. But Alaska, as you know, ANWR, National Wildlife Arctic Refuge, has been shut down. And ANWR is not that much. It's only, 100,000 acres or something like that. It's not very big. Yet, modern technology now, you can drill 20 miles underground sideways. So there's no reason to believe that we can't be outside of ANWR and drill underneath and get the oil. But they're not even allowing oil companies to go in and put in a minor footprint of something like 4 or 5 acres and drill down and get the oil.
And that is directly. Because that's locked up as well?
Politically locked up by the environmentalists, yeah. And that's the same thing pretty much true of our coasts. Now, does that benefit the oil companies? Well, sure. By actually disallowing oil companies to go and get the oil out of the ground, right, it lessens the supply, increases the price, and therefore they make more money. So you can say they're in collusion, but I would tend to doubt that assertion. I would say that they're more like, they want to get in there. They want to make money. They want to, lessen their job is to really make things better for the United States. And P.S., of the worldwide oil supplies that we know as proven reserves today, only less than 3% is controlled by private companies. The rest of it's all owned by governments.
Okay. How does the energy independence, how can it be made to happen if human beings are not in charge of it, really?
They can't.
Unless we're using completely advanced alternative energy solutions that are not even being utilized in modern times.
Well, ask yourself, how many types of energy have been effectively reduced or taken off the table by environmental laws? Oil and gas exploration is one of them, right?
Right.
Nuclear power would be another one. It's been taken off by politics, not by science. Hydroelectric has been effectively taken off again by environmentalists. That is dams and rivers, right? And the fourth one you could actually say is it's in its infancy and yet hasn't been attacked. It's being talked about in some circles is solar power in space.
That's interesting.
Very interesting. Very,
wow.
Very interesting. What they do is they build these platforms in space that collect the solar energy and beam it back to Earth in microwave form.
Microwave form?
Microwave, yeah.
Wow. We have enough microwave radiation on this planet.
And that goes back to what you're talking about, by microwaves, electromagnetic pulse radiation problems. But let's not go there. That's a really complicated issue.
Yeah. Oh, I've already been there. You just used the term environmentalist. What do you mean when you say that?
Well, let's just say this straight up. I'm an environmentalist.
Me too.
But I don't believe that mankind's activities on Earth are the primary cause of its problems. Yes, we do cause problems. And yes, we are greedy and self-interested. Yes, let's just take that as a given. But that self-interest doesn't go to the extent that we're willing to completely destroy the Earth in order to get what we want, because we know that that destruction is suicide. So we will make mistakes. Humans do that on a regular and minute-to-minute daily basis. But in general, people don't do that. Now, environmentalists believe almost exactly the opposite, that mankind's the problem, and that mankind should be shut down because of its greed and or whatever else you want. Most environmentalists, and I have friends who still work for Maine Audubon, work for the Natural Resources Council of Maine, these people are in love with wind power.
That's why I said everybody I've ever known that was concerned about the environment fell in love with wind power. And I would say, based on what you've described, there's a seduction about it.
Correct. Absolutely. But the problem is that most of these people actually don't make money in the private sector, or does their money come from the private sector? So they really don't. They have a completely disconnect from reality of economics and what the conditions that most people live and work in on a daily basis.
I would think if someone said to me, Kim, I want you to know wind power is really, on a whole systems level, inefficient. If I didn't hear what you just said, and if it couldn't be verified, I would say that's bunk. You know what I'm saying? Because I've been told to accept that wind power is an energy saver, that it can make us energy independent, that it's inexpensive. You know what I'm saying? All these things that are associated with the cell on it. So,
right. Well, going back to what I was talking about earlier about this studies that have been done by Spain, Denmark, and Germany. These studies were just done in the last year, so they're all very recent studies, and they look back over the last 30, 40 years, 10 years of experience for these countries. And there, you just go and Google Danish wind power experience, and you'll eventually come to it, or Spain or Germany. These studies are out there on the Internet. Going back to that problem that you're talking about, these are all interconnected, and what they've done in our minds is create this image by using several fears that wind power is the solution to. The fear is, of course, that we're going to run out of hydrocarbons and wind will provide an unlimited source of power. The fear is that we're going to keep sending our money overseas to foreign countries that hate us, and wind power will allow us to harness our own energy and we'll be independent.
You spoke in our first conversation about this concern for deep-level corruption. What do you mean?
Okay, in the state of Maine specifically, First Wind is the company that's driving most of these energy projects.
Right, you shared that part.
Now, First Wind is development director, a guy named Kurt Adams. He was formerly John Baldacci, who is currently governor, his chief counsel, his lawyer. He became also, while Baldacci he's still governor until the end of this year. He became governor in 2002. Baldacci appointed him as the head of what we call the Public Utilities Commission, or PUC, in the state. While there, he basically caused the local small utilities to divest themselves and break themselves up into parts that, you know, basically production on one side and transmission on the other. So he was instrumental in making sure this split up occurred. And also, then, after putting into what we call renewable production standards for the state of Maine.
And what does that mean?
Renewable production standards basically calls for new energy sources that are alternative or renewable energy sources. In other words, in the state of Maine, there's only two you can choose from.
Does it have to be approved of?
Yes, wind power or what's known as tidal power. Okay.
And what is tidal power?
Tidal power is they put these big propellers under the water where the tide flow is pretty strong. As you probably know, Bay of Fundy is one of the biggest strong tidal flows in the Atlantic. So they put these big propellers underwater and they turn when the tide goes in and out, and then that turning is connected to a turbine which produces electricity. So it's like using water to turn propellers, which makes electricity. So Kurt Adams put into these rules that we had to get to a renewable energy production standard of 40. Well, it started out at 30%. Now it's 40% from these alternative sources only, not hydroelectric, which is also on a federal level known as a renewable energy source. Hydroelectric being, you know, dams and rivers, and or what's known as coal generation, which is a combination of using oil or natural gas plus biomass, which is trash or trees. And then biomass, which is just burning wood. Now, we in Maine, 42% of our power comes from hydroelectric, biomass, and cogeneration already. About 52% is natural gas, and 8% is bought power from other sources. So we don't have really a renewable energy problem, but Kurt Adams put this in place. Then he jumped ship to First Wind a month later and became their director of production. And since then, Maine went the next step, which is we did this whole study on where to expedite the permitting process to site and make sure these things were put up around the state. Now, there are sites all over the state right now, something like in the order of 15 that are under permitting or under construction or in service. And each one of these sites takes approximately, well, the estimates range between 25 and 50,000 acres will be clear-cut and destroyed in the state of Maine on the mountaintops.
Why?
Well, every one of these towers you put up takes anywhere from 3 to 8 acres. They have to clear-cut and level it, is gone. Woodlands, boop, gone. And they cut out the mountainside because these blades have to turn without interference. And they have to be flat in order to level the machines that are on top of these, you know, anywhere from 150 to 250-foot towers. The blades themselves are 150 to 225 feet long. So anyway, they have to clear-cut and destroy land, and they have to be at least 1,500 feet apart. So, you know, you do the math. You have to, the roads have to be wide enough to allow a tractor-trailer on a two-lane highway, basically. It's about 25 to 50,000 acres.
That's terrible.
Absolutely.
That's painful to hear.
Now, every year, according to U.S. Fish and Wildlife, somewhere between 20 and 40 birds are killed by each turbine. In Spain's experience, they in a 10-year period, killed 3 million migratory birds.
Are you serious?
Serious. And on a yearly basis, there's something in the order of 1,200 hawks and eagles are killed by turbines in Spain.
So who's the real environmentalist? You are.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, so Kurt Adams is now the head of he was the head of the PUC. He's now head of First Wind. And it's been not only...
So first, wait a minute. First, a person creates the policy.
Creates the policy.
Then runs over to the corporate end.
Correct, to get the money from the policy he created.
Aren't you concerned for your life over there?
Oh, tell you what. I've been talking about this for 3 years now, and people are just finally waking up to it. And unfortunately, it may be too late. Okay, so here's the next step, okay? Remember that Kurt Adams went so far as to make Central Maine Power, which was a local utility, split into two parts, production and transmission. The transmission was bought by, or is owned now by a company called FPL, which is owned by a company called Energy East, which is owned by a Spanish company named Iberdrola. Recently, Governor Baldacci went on a trip to visit the wind turbines in Spain and Denmark. It was all a gag when he came back and said, well, we should put these companies back together, put the production and the transmission together. And that's where the transmission line problem comes back into play, because the transmission lines in Maine cannot accommodate the variation of power surges that would be put into place because of the wind turbines. So we have to reconstruct our entire grid system to accommodate wind, which would cost somewhere between $8 and $10 billion. And the cost of putting up these wind turbines just on the land itself is about $2 billion. Adding that to the cost of electricity in our rate system will drive up our cost from 15 to maybe 24, 25 cents a kilowatt.
So where's the efficiency? Where's
no
the independence? Where's the saving the environment?
Yeah, good question. Done. Period.
This is painful to hear.
Wind is not the solution to our energy problem. It's not the solution to lowering the cost and getting United States, Maine specifically, or United States more efficient and therefore more competitive and economically viable. And wind is not going to reduce our CO2, even if you think that's a problem in the first place. And it will not help the environment because it's destroying it, putting up these wind farms. It's the wrong solution, period. Never mind that. The way they pay for it is through deficit financing, adding more to our debt, which creates less independence because the Chinese are buying our debt.
Talk about deficit financing and aggregate demand, please.
Okay, aggregate demand. Economic concept is that how do you figure out what the consumer... They talk about it on TV as, but we got to increase consumer demand.
Right.
So aggregate demand is how much money the consumers are spending in order to drive business. So if you break it down into its component parts, there are really three parts to aggregate demand. One is income, in other words, your job, or, you know, income from investments and other sources like that. The other is savings. You can take money out of the savings you had previously and spend that. That's demand. That'll help demand. And the third is borrowing, and that is when you loosen up underwriting standards like we had from 2002 to 2007, it increases the amount of people can borrow, and therefore that increases aggregate demand. So the question is, what decreases aggregate demand?
Great question.
So obviously, losing your job will decrease your ability to consume. Losing or having a job income cut will reduce your ability to consume.
That's for sure.
If you also have the same job and instead of spending that money, you put it into savings, that will reduce aggregate demand. Your savings go up, which increases your ability to consume in the future, but your consumption goes down because you're putting the money into a bank or other kind of place.
Let's say other investments for other purposes of what's happening now in the world.
And third is, of course, you can actually have a problem because you've gone bankrupt, and that reduces borrowing demand, right? Or instead of losing your job and having all the other problems, instead of you pay down your debt faster than you would have otherwise. So you're using the same amount of cash to do two different things which reduce aggregate demand. Okay, now think about this on an individual basis. You think about this on a company basis. The other thing that individuals and companies do is they look out and they go, well, I'm a little uncertain as to whether my job is going to be around. So they'll reduce their spending and put it into savings. Or they'll reduce their borrowing because they're afraid that if they borrow money, they're going to lose their job, so they reduce that. So uncertainty reduces aggregate demand. And that's what we have right now in the economy. We have a lot of uncertainty. You know, government policies are changing. There's a lot of things going on in the economy that are disruptive. Borrowing is more difficult. You know, underwriting standards have gotten a lot tighter. All those things go about to reducing aggregate demand. Now, the way the government goes about stimulating aggregate demand, it goes into deficit financing. So this is a concept which has been around for hundreds of thousands of years, but it was codified by a guy named John Maynard Keynes into what's known as a system economic thinking called Keynesianism. And Keynesian basically said that during recessions, government can increase aggregate demand by going into deficit financing.
Is that what you're relaying about the wind power, its form of deficit financing?
Okay. Summary of the point was and is, Keynes was wrong. Doesn't work. Now, the short answer is, in 1930s, when Keynes came up with this general economic theory for demand, 1930, right, during the Depression.
Right.
Since 1930 to 2000, what happened to the United Kingdom?
I don't know.
It's gone from a world power back to the pre-1600 borders, actually pre-1200 borders of England. It's gone from being a strong, viable economy to one that's negligible on the world scene. So using government spending only adds to government spending because the problem is you never really reduce it. It's very difficult once you start down the road of government spending to reduce government spending because people become dependent on it. And what you get into is a spiral of what's known in economic circles as the
Sorry to interrupt you, but to me it's like the exponential factor. It exponentiates out of control. It compounds into the Netherlands.
Correct. Because what you've got is the attitude that I'm going to get mine as soon as I can because I don't know if it's going to be around tomorrow, number one. And number two, well, I'm going to just step back a second here and go to what's called the tragedy of the commons principle. Have you ever heard of this?
No.
Okay. Back in the colonial days, in the center of town, there was a place called the commons, right?
Right.
It was green in the middle of the town. Well, everybody who visited the town and put their horse or cow in there, and it would graze around, and it would be fine, right?
One would think.
It was a commons because it was owned by the town, and everybody, you know, could put their animals there. But what happened, of course, is that people started putting their animals there who weren't visiting the town, and they would just eat the thing down to dirt in no time flat because it was free or perceived to be free. Now, that's fine in a small little town. You take that to an economy, and you get the situation where we've got with immigrants coming in and using our services and not having to pay for them. You get people who just keep on adding on to the government services, and it gets even worse when you get to, like, you know, companies doing this. You know, major companies like First Wind, for instance, they get dependent on the government subsidy, and they're going to get it as fast as they can to put these things up, and they don't care whether or not these things really produce electricity.
So it's kind of like a parasitic organism.
Absolutely.
That has manifested itself into a systemic structure that is being empowered by policy first, and then corporate structure to play it out.
Correct. Now, I jokingly refer to these people in the political realm, as you say, parasites, right? But political hacks, let's put it that way, okay, are these type of people. They're basically concerned with the sustenance, maintenance, and perpetuation of government. That's what they're most interested in. Now, they do recognize that people, Homo sapiens, actually are important to their survival, but they're really not really concerned about that in the long run. They're concerned about their own perpetuation. So we can kind of jokingly refer to them as not Homo sapiens sapiens, but a subspecies thereof called Homo hacus hacus. Okay, so then you can kind of go really down the road to absurdity and think about this in a way. All right, so then there's the elite form, you know, guys like in the state of Maine, those would be Olympia Snow and Susan Collins and John Baldacci, right? And those are Homo hacus elitis.
Sounds like a clinical problem.
Yeah, this is definitely a problem you got to worry about. Now, there's their staff, right? So they're Homo hacus staffus. They're definitely concerned about their jobs and keeping the perpetuation, sustenance, and maintenance of the government. That's their job. Now, then there's the Homo hacus bacchus, who are the people who actually back them, you know, with monetary or political support, right? And then there's the people who actually do their campaign work. In this state, that would be a guy like Christopher Potholm, who's known for his, you know, going across borders, whichever, he's a mercenary as far as that goes, Homo hacus spinus. Now, this is really ridiculous, but think of a picture of Monica Lewinsky, Homo hacus sexus. Now, if you recognize the fact that she represents only one subspecies, you can actually think that historically this has been evident for thousands of years. Think of Cleopatra.
I can see how your wildlife experience leading bird tours and...
In other words, I've turked this ad absurdum, right? Homo hacus hacus is a subspecies of humankind, which is parasitic on Homo sapiens sapiens.
This is funny. It's not funny, but it's funny.
Yeah, it's revealing, but it's not funny. Going back to the aggregate demand issue.
Right.
The problem with the Homo hacus hacus on the aggregate demand is they're taking out of the actual ability for aggregate demand to increase. They are non-productive dead weight on the economy. So, in fact, the best way to actually increase the economy is to reduce government.
In order to consider reducing government, they're going to have to talk to a gentleman named D. Hawk.
And who's that?
He has written a book on the chaotic organism about how companies and industries can be set up from the ground of chaos and how, instead of being top down, they can be set up like an effective organism that organizes for human betterment and effectiveness and efficiency. And instead of just to replicate and expand itself, it's self-replicating to produce a whole system where there's this interconnectedness and you don't have this ability to disconnect activity and consciousness and process and protocol from everything else. D. Hawk was the founder of Visa. And he set it up, instead of from a top down, from what he calls chaotic company, chaotic organism, and took away and stripped down a lot of the structures and ways of acting that most corporations try to set themselves up to do, well, that are control-based. So he took out the whole control mechanism. Yep. He used this model in the setting up of Visa. It's much more complex than what I'm articulating, but... The bottom line is that what you're describing here is that government is an organism that is dedicated to expanding itself and replicating itself and expanding its ability to control.
Correct, which is detrimental to anything that needs
correct.
To adapt.
But see, it and doesn't know that. It doesn't know the extent to which that is a virus in and of itself.
Correct.
And to the extent to which... That is antithetical to bringing in an entire universe of new solutions and discoveries and better efficiencies and effectiveness for being energy independent, for getting the grid protected from all kinds of things that it's not even provisioned for right now, and other types of concerns that we have environmentally.
The whole thing that you just described,
yes,
is really based on the concept of what's known as chaos theory.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
That the more... And chaos theory is actually proven scientifically that the more structure you have in a system, the less likely it is to survive. And in fact, it's more prone to extinction.
The real question is, it's a question of how to have the kind of dialogue, how to transmit the kind of scenario building that would allow governments to become excited with a new direction of opportunity that they've never had before. and then to give them the tools to set up what's next and a bridge to help them in the transition so they can let go and allow certain things to happen that normally everything in their being, everything in their consciousness, everything in their policy would normally prevent and obstruct from happening.
Yeah, it screams for them to stop.
Yeah, and so the book by Dee Hawk and also someone like Betty Sue Flowers would be very, very helpful to talk with governments. And I interviewed her some years ago, and she'll be back, actually, on the show soon.
If you the other book that I would recommend, I think we talked about it last time, was John Gribben's book, Deep Simplicity.
Well, that sounds like a great book. I haven't read it yet, but I look
forward to it.
It really
is. John Gribben's an astrophysicist. And by the way, the concept that I got back when we were repeating about talking about the ice ages and, you know, how do they get caused, he wrote another book called Ice Age, which is now out of print, but you can find it. It talks about that. It's 100-page long. It's just so lucid and clear as why mankind can't change this problem. Anyway, the other book, Deep Simplicity, talks about all of its ramifications, not only in astrophysics, but right down to the basic genetic structure, why this is an important concept to understand. And you can apply the same concepts from, you know, the concept of chaos theory to why economies fail, because they just do. They get too structured and organized, either because they're capitalistic, monopolistic structures that are built that prevent adaptation to new economic conditions, or governments do the same thing, or dictators do the same thing, or monarchies do the same. They develop these huge structures which prevent people from adapting to whatever new change things come along, and they just collapse.
Remember, we are in a transition, you and all the rest of us are in this huge transition of humanity, moving from a society that's all based on ownership and control into something totally different. But we're in the transition, so it's kind of like being half born. It's very uncomfortable. And so there's a great, in my view, a great rush to seize the last bit of control that people can get. And I think that the people that truly need the help, it's not just the ordinary person. It's truly the leaders of antiquated older models that were based on command and control, military models, and military paradigms that are being used and executed, and I mean the word executed, in government, and it is a cultural thing, and it affects all the processes, the procedures, the protocols, how, quote, consensus is actually built. It involves the foreground and the behind the scenes of how people are treated and bullied and what's done and the threats that are made and
led and misled.
Yeah, all that kind of stuff. Yep. And so it's this very exciting and nerve-wracking time because the stakes are so high. What would you like to recommend in closing this chapter of our dialogue to audiences at this time?
First, obviously do a lot of your own research. And you can do a lot of it through the internet. Second, read some important books. And third, believe almost nothing you see in the press. In fact, the best thing to do is to turn off the mainstream media and stop reading the mainstream newspapers. Once you start doing that, then you'll have to go out and find other sources. And you'll find sources that, number one, are credible, and number two, that you can rely on. And that, number three, either they tell you exactly where their biases and prejudices are, and therefore you're clear about what you believe and don't believe from that source, or you recognize what those are. And the problem is that, you know, the whole paradigm of where you gather information is collapsing. But a lot of it's gotten so biased that you cannot rely on it anymore. You got to rely on your own ability to gather information and make connections that are relevant to your own life. And fortunately, with the internet, we have the ability to do so. One of the most important books I would read is a book by Robert Cialdini called Influence.
Sounds great.
It has to do with how we are hardwired to make bad decisions. And another book I would recommend, and actually in there there's The Psychology of Misjudgment. It's a book by Charlie Munger, who was the chairman of Berkshire Hathaway. It's the book's called Poor Charlie's Almanac.
Sounds fun.
And in there. You can get that. Just Google Paul Charlie's Almanac, and you can find the book. It's a big kind of tabletop book, but it's well worth reading. And a lot of the books that I mentioned are in the back of this book as a reading list. I was at the annual meeting for Berkshire Hathaway a few years ago, and I asked him, you know, you put all this stuff together. Have you developed a college-level course for shareholders of Berkshire Hathaway that would help us understand not only why and how you run this company, but also to pass that knowledge on to our heirs, which is really our most important legacy? And he said, I did that. Go buy my book, Poor Charlie's Almanac, down in the corner of, you know, the Omaha Center. Yep, I did. I bought 3 copies. I gave them to all my brothers and sisters. Anyway, that book, Deep Simplicity's in there, Ice Age is in there, books by John Fenneman are in there. There's all sorts of great stuff in here. Use your own mind is the point.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've been speaking with Lawrence Dwight Jr., founder and president of the Dwight Investment Council. He can be reached at buffettstyle.net, BUFFETTSTYLE.net. There'll be a link on the site. I'd really want to thank you for being on the show and sharing with us about how we need to rethink wind power, sharing about deficit financing and the concept of aggregate demand and what we need to know, and sharing about the state of Maine and making distinctions about connections and corrupted activity that is blocking the flow of actually being energy independent and stimulating jobs in a real economy. Thank you so much for being on the show.
If anyone likes to, you can go to my website, get my phone number if they have any questions.
You can be reached at 207-645-9415. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kim.